Hello, Jenny Murray, welcoming you to Friday's edition of the Woman's Hour podcast. Good morning. Now, I like chicken a lot, which is just as well, as Diana Henry's latest cookbook is A Bird in the Hand, and I'm looking forward to a spicy salsa to go with the meat. Mother's Day's on Sunday, I hope you're listening, boys. How does the way you were mothered shape the mother you become? We reveal your Woman of the Week, and on Comic Relief Day, visit a project in Kenya that's given a group of women a new lease of life. Now, Naomi Klein came to international attention when she published a book called No Logo. She railed against the brand name culture and the use of sweatshop workers to produce the branded clothes. It was said to have politicised a whole generation. In This Changes Everything, she tackles the controversial subject of climate change, a topic to which she says she came late. I spoke to her earlier from Montreal. What incidents prompted her concern?
I think we are all concerned whether or not we're talking about it. You know, I think there's a sort of a low-level malaise. It's sort of this issue that we are catching glimpses of out of the corner of our eye, that we're always kind of looking away from it because it's so overwhelming. But for me, it really was Hurricane Katrina. I really felt when I was in New Orleans in the midst of the flood, actually, I was there when the city was still flooded and spent a few weeks reporting from there, returned several times. I felt like I was looking at the future for all of us if we don't change course. Because in New Orleans, you had this collision between heavy weather, and you know, you can never connect one storm to climate change, but we do know that warming oceans produce more powerful hurricanes, and Katrina was an incredibly powerful hurricane. But that storm collided with weak and neglected public infrastructure, and that's what really turned it into a catastrophe. The levees broke, and then the state, the arms of government that are charged with taking care of people in the midst of disaster, just abandoned them. People were abandoned on their rooftops. They were abandoned in the Superdome. And you had this kind of science fiction dystopic reality where, if you had money, you were taken care of. You had private security. You had all of these private protections. But if you depended on the state, you were vilified as looters and then turned into internal refugees. So it was seeing that possible future that made me want to write a book that answered a question that I came across a lot when I was touring with the Shock Doctrine, which is, how do we prevent this tactic? Is there a way of responding to crisis that brings us together as opposed to apart, that builds a fairer society instead of a more unequal one?
One of the things you say really worried and upset you. You say you were worried about your son never seeing a moose. Why did you concern yourself with the moose?
Well, writing this book took 5 years, and over the course of that 5 years, I became a mother. And one of the things about the way we talk about climate change is that it's very kind of clinical, and it's a really jargon-laden world, right? You've got the scientific jargon, then you've got the policy jargon, the feed-in tariffs and the cap-and-trades, and then you've got the United Nations jargon of IPCCs and UNFCCCs. And so there's this real distancing that happens. So even though I was totally immersed in the scientific material, the climate models, there was a way that it wasn't really reaching me emotionally. And I found that what really snuck up on me and made this real for me was when I would take breaks from writing the book and go and read stories to my then one-year-old. And children's literature is filled with animals. And I guess it was probably the first time I ever cried about climate change was when I was reading my son a book called Looking for a Moose, which I had actually read him 100 times before. It's his favorite book, about a group of kids that desperately wants to see a moose, and they look high and low. And the joke is that there's a moose hiding on every page, but they don't see it. And then at the very end, all the moose come out of hiding and all the kids go, we've never, ever, ever, ever seen so many moose. And then suddenly it hit me that he may never see a moose because there's an extinction crisis going on with moose in North America. And they are one of the most climate vulnerable species. Just suddenly this topic that I thought I was scared about became terrifying.
Now, I know that you're not altogether fond of the capitalist system from having read No Logo, but why do you see the root of climate change as a sort of battle between capitalism and the planet?
if we want to understand why we have failed so catastrophically to meet this crisis, even though we've known about it and we've been warned about it now for 2.5 decades. I mean, scientists have known about it for much longer, but this really became a mainstream top of consciousness issue in the late 1980s. So what I do in the book is look at what else was happening and conclude that the reason why we have failed is because this crisis has a catastrophically bad case of bad timing, because 1988 was the high point of the end of history moment. This was when Francis Fukuyama was declaring history over. Margaret Thatcher had said there is no such thing as society. The Berlin Wall fell the next year. And the reason why this matters is because the ideological project that was being locked in this period made it extremely difficult for us to do the things that are necessary in the face of the climate crisis. Regulation became a dirty word. Of course, we need to regulate corporations. We need to tell them that they can't emit CO2 at the levels that they've been doing it. Instead, we had all of these sort of smoke and mirrors, cap and trade and emission trade, and we tried to get it to adhere to the logic of the market. We also were privatizing our energy systems, our transit systems, and these are the parts of the state that are central to any kind of energy transition. We need to reimagine our transit system, switch to renewable energy to power, you know, mass transit. We need it to be affordable. It can't be profit-driven because we need everybody to use it, but here we were selling it off. So the argument I make is that that particular sort of no-holds-barred capitalism is what made us fail to act, but also we were celebrating this very, very high consumer lifestyle and exporting it to every corner of the world. So, of course, that led to an emission increase. It's not that we didn't do anything. It's that we made things much, much worse. Global emissions went up by 60% in the years when we were supposed to be lowering emissions.
There are, of course, climate change deniers. How do you deal with their rejection of your research?
I think there's such a high degree of scientific consensus. 97% of active climate scientists agree that human-caused climate change is real. I have a chapter in the book on the climate change denier movement. It's born in these right-wing think tanks in the United States. Heartland, which hosts these conferences, notably is not a scientific organization. It is a free market think tank. And when you go to these gatherings, you see the intellectual think tanks that have advanced the project that I've been describing: deregulation, privatization, austerity, free trade. So of course they reject the science, because if the science is true and we really are in the midst of an existential emergency, and we are, then their entire intellectual scaffolding falls apart. Their ideology cannot survive, and they know it. So I don't honestly spend much time debating climate scientists, nor do I think major media outlets should. I think there are huge debates to be had about how we respond, but I don't think we should be debating whether or not there is a crisis. I think we don't have that kind of time to waste.
What do you say then to people who say, well, I have to fly to get on my holiday or to do my business. I have to drive my car to get to my appointment. I hate wind farms.
Well, it's really interesting about wind turbines and the pushback on it. There's been some research about this that finds that when communities have control over the development of wind and solar in their areas, there's much more public support. And if you look at countries that have embraced wind on a very large scale, like Germany and Denmark, what's notable about those cases is that there are hundreds of energy co-ops that have emerged in Germany as part of the transition. In Denmark, 40% of the electricity comes from renewables. Much of it is wind, but a great deal of it is owned by co-ops and municipalities. The NIMBY phenomenon, the not in my backyard phenomenon, does not exist in Denmark, and it doesn't exist in Germany. People want the wind farms on their land because they're benefiting from them and they feel a sense of democratic control over them.
And those of us who embrace modern life and continue to fly and drive.
This book is not one of those environmental books that makes the issue all about whether you personally recycle and what your personal carbon footprint is, which is not to say that that isn't important, but I think that the much larger issue is that most people don't have the ability to make good decisions. We haven't made it easy for people. So I think that we've made a mistake by focusing so much on those individual shopping decisions and not enough on what the bold public policies need to be so that all of us have better choices about how we move around. And we need to stop, I think, scapegoating individuals and saying, well, this is all just because, you know, we're greedy. And this idea that this is an anti-modern position, I also think I'd like to push back a little bit on, because the kind of transition that I'm talking about relies on extremely modern, exciting technologies. And there have been huge advances in renewable energy and battery storage in recent years. So we're not talking about going backwards. We're talking about smart technologies that respect the limits of our natural system and how much pollution our systems can absorb.
And how soon do you expect governments, after 20 years of talking about this, not making much progress, do you expect your "this changes everything" to happen?
Well, look, it's not just mine. I mean, the final section of the book is all about this new wave of climate activism that has emerged in recent years, whether it is communities banding together to refuse fracking in their backyard, whether it's university students demanding that their schools divest their holdings from fossil fuels, whether it's the 400,000 people who marched in New York City in September demanding climate action and climate justice, there is a growing movement, and it's winning some significant victories. I mean, we've seen Obama stand up to the Republicans again and again over the Keystone XL pipeline. This is quite unexpected, and it's very much a victory of this grassroots movement. So there is progress, but it's a race against time. You know, the movement is growing. It's growing very quickly. But we have to get this turned around in the right direction by the end of this decade. So I think that the climate talks in Paris this year are really significant. And the fact that there is this UN climate summit is becoming a catalyst for the anti-austerity movement to join very strongly with the climate justice movement in a time when we're facing a crisis of this magnitude. I have a lot of hope in that coalition coming together.
I was talking to Naomi Klein. Now, chicken in my house is one of the staples. There's always a pack of portions in the freezer, and a whole bird for the family is a popular Sunday lunch. It's good just roasted with the skin on. I really can't bear skinless chicken, but there are days when you open the fridge and think, what can I do to make this more interesting? Well, Diana Henry, who you just heard laughing, her latest cookbook sets out to answer that question. It's called A Bird in the Hand, and it's only about chicken. Now, you've brought pre-cooked chicken, and you're going to make a salsa, and it doesn't have any skin on it, does it?
It doesn't have any skin on it because it was in a marinade. And if you're going to cook chicken, if you're going to marinate chicken, you want it to go into the flesh. And I knew that if I left the skin on, even though you requested it, that you'd end up with skin that had the lovely crusty marinade on it, and then you wouldn't have so much of it underneath. So it's skinless, boneless chicken thighs, and they were marinated overnight in olive oil, some cayenne, some cumin, and some chili as well, and cinnamon, because that's a kind of Turkish spice thing. And then I cooked them for you right before I left the house, so they're here and they're actually still warm. And I'm going to make
the
salsa. Yeah. This is the chicken itself has got turkey seasoning in it. Somebody told me they'd had a salsa in Turkey, and they described it to me, what it was. It was olives, it was coriander. And I thought, that sounds fantastic. So I can't claim the authenticity of this, but this is as they described it. So it is 70 grams of pisset green olives, and I've chopped those all up. And here, I've got to make sure you don't get too big bits of these. There's one green chili and one red chili that have got to go in.
Oh, be careful, because I won't be able to speak for the rest of the programme.
No, I know that's hazard, and I will put a big dollop of yogurt on the side, so you'll be all right. And it's better to do this in a mortar and pestle, because you can chop it all together if you don't have one. But there's a thing about melding and getting the juices out of the herbs. So in here, I've got 2 cloves of garlic, and this has just been crushed with some salt. And I'm going to put the chilies into this, and they'll get crushed a bit as well. So they're just chopped up. And then my favourite herb must be coriander. I absolutely love it. People have quite extreme views on it. You either kind of love it or you hate it. But now I think it's second most popular herb in this country under parsley. So we have really taken Eastern Mediterranean and Southeast Asian dishes to our heart, I think, because we like this. So that's about 15 grams. That goes in as well. And lots of torn mint.
And the lemon juice?
A little bit in. What I'm going to put in, this is, I use this quite a lot. It's white balsamic, so it doesn't have the, it doesn't make things go dark the way the dark balsamic does. So just two spoonfuls of this. Lemon juice will go in a minute. This isn't very Turkish, but I think this needed a tiny little bit of sweetness, and white balsamic has this. And six tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil. And then I'll just mix everything together. I think one of the good things about chicken, and one of the reasons why we like it and cook it a lot during the week, is that it lends itself very well to accessorising. You can kind of like cook it quite plainly. I mean, I'm a great... What I can't do with a packet of chicken thighs, to be honest, isn't worth knowing. I will open, you know, twice a week, I'll kind of open the fridge and there'll be a packet of chicken thighs there.
But how did your passion for chicken start? I mean, it's unusual to make a whole cookbook about one meat.
I really like it. And I think it's become undervalued among sort of food writers and foodies. They will tell you that it's kind of quite bland. It doesn't taste it very much. And I think it's lovely. And funny enough, when I started turning around talking about the book, you find that other people love it as well. And they really need to find ways to cook it. But I've got a kind of emotional attachment to it. And I think a lot of us have, in that, you know, when my mum said it's roast chicken with stuffing and sauteed potatoes, we all went, yay, because it is that when you bring a roast chicken in and you put it on the table, whether it's in the middle of the week or on a Sunday, we have a kind of like real feeling of the work I had for.
But, you know, there's so much controversy about it at the moment. I know this makes you cross, but well, what do you say to the Food Standards Agency reporting that 3/4 of supermarket chicken has campylobacteria? And Hugh Fernley Whittenstall had this huge campaign to encourage supermarkets to stop intensive poultry farming and sell quality, maybe more expensive chickens.
I have got very mixed feelings on it, in that I don't think that I can tell people they can't eat chicken unless they're willing to spend £10 on a bird. At the other end of the scale, I wouldn't blame farmers for the fact that there's problems with chicken. I think in order for them to make money, they have to, the throughput has to be quite high. They have to, I wouldn't say cut corners, but I think sometimes not enough care may be taken. But the thing is that once you're in the kitchen, if you handle chicken properly, there isn't a problem. If you cook it properly and you don't put, you know, it's that basic stuff. Don't put raw chicken on a board that you've had cooked, raw chicken with cooked and that kind of thing. So with basic hygiene at home and wash your hands all the time, there shouldn't be a problem. So
when you say wash your hands all the time, is that wash your hands every time you've touched?
When I'm actually cooking chicken, and it's funny to be in here without a sink behind me, I will kind of like, I'll marinate it, put it in the fridge, and I'll wash my hands. Then I might do something else. Then, and I'll, you know, at each stage, I just as a kind of matter of course, I go to the sink behind me and I wash my hands. And then I won't, if the tea towel's been used, that will go into the wash as well. It's just getting into that mindset.
And cooking,
I think,
it to make sure you've cooked it through.
Mm. You don't have to cook it so that it's dry. I mean, if you're roasting a whole bird, you just have to go in between the chicken leg and the main body and see what colour the juices are, and they should be pink. But I think chicken, every time I talk about chicken, people ask these things. They go, let's talk about salmonella. And it's about, I think we love it. And I think it's about joy. And I think we all have quite an emotional attachment to it. And I think we should be positive about it and not always talk about the negative things.
Am I quickly going to taste this?
You are.
Fierce sauce.
It's not too fierce, don't worry.
Come on, quick, or we'll run out of time.
I hope you're hungry.
I'll tell you what, shall I taste it during the next item?
Okay.
And then say what I think about it later.
You do that.
Diana Henry, I will wait for the hot sauce. Now, still to come in today's programme, we reveal your Woman of the Week, and on Comic Relief Day, the Kenyan Community Engagement Initiative Network and the women your money has given a new lease of life. And a quick reminder about the podcast, if you're not able to listen every day, you can go to the website, download us, and it's free. Now, earlier this week, we were talking about mothers and daughters and what a difficult relationship it can be. But what impact does the way your mother treated you have on the kind of mother you become? Now, mine was super critical of me. I now get emails from my sons when I shower them with praise, saying, a little constructive criticism might be useful, Mum. So I've gone the opposite way. Mother in the Mother is a storytelling project in Bristol exploring that theme. The organiser, Pippa Robinson, worked with around 100 mothers for some 3 years. Millie Charles met some of the women who took part and spoke to Pippa. What was the inspiration for the project?
I was absolutely convinced during pregnancy that I was having a boy. And at the point when I gave birth and I was told it was a girl, I just remember thinking about this daughter that I'd just given birth to, giving birth herself one day. And I felt in that moment sort of directly connected up to this line of women that would potentially come after me, and with that to the line of women that came before me as well. A couple of years after that, my maternal grandmother died. Before my nan died, she had a stroke and she was in hospital, and I was visiting her there, and I was with my daughter and my mum was there as well, who I hadn't seen for a long time. And another relative sort of pointed out how there were these four generations of women all in the hospital at the same time. And again, it was this really kind of powerful realisation. It made me feel that there were these connections that ran deeper than all the kind of various difficulties and challenges that there were within my family. There was something, this kind of thread of maternal lineage that ran a lot deeper than that, and something that kind of mattered more in some ways.
So my name is Charlotte and I'm 42. My mother suffers with alcoholism. She's drinking. I, like a lot of women, am not going to have the relationship I wanted with my mother. I'm not going to have the mother I wanted or needed. And it's about how to be in that and what to do with it. You know, people tell me it's something I might get over, but I don't think so. So I need to look at this thing about how do I make it into something else, take it from being painful and make it into a power that motivates me towards being an excellent mother myself.
When you had your first child, Elijah, or when you first became pregnant, did you become more aware of this relationship with your mother?
As time went on and I realised just what a challenging job mothering is, I felt a mixture of, I did feel some new understanding, but I felt some new anger as well, because it is such an important job.
What lessons do you take from your own childhood, and how do you use that in the way you mother your sons?
I think what comes up for me the most is around self-regulation. I think that's what I felt Mum never did. She didn't regulate herself and then couldn't regulate me. So I take that very seriously. I think my little boys need me to help regulate them. And by regulate, I mean just balance them all the time, their environment, their life, their feelings, you know, just this is the way. This is the way life is. This is, you know, and leave enough space for them to hopefully express who they are. On a downside, I think it makes me probably too fussy, mother too much.
Do you feel that because your mother was absent on many levels that you're more anxious about being present?
Totally feel that, yeah. Things like just really wanting him to be warm enough or all that stuff, whereas like, well, my husband thinks we can feel a little bit of cold, you know, it will be all right. But for me, that whole situation becomes very charged because I slip into thinking, no, he mustn't feel any pain because of my own pain. And it was pointed out by a very wonderful friend of mine when Elijah was very young. She said to me, Elijah was crying, we were in the supermarket and I couldn't pick him up for about a minute. And she said, why are you crying? I was really crying. And I said, because he's crying and I can't pick him up. And she said, life will happen to him. You can't stop it. What your role is to resource him. You love him. That's what you do, which resources him. And then he faces life. But you can't stop life, you know.
You recorded a story that's on the website in the collection of stories, and you very much focused on the positive aspects and attributes of your mother and what made your mother a beautiful person,
yeah,
and the good qualities that she has. Mm. Was that something new for you?
That was new for me, and that was what was amazing about doing the course with Pippa. when I sat around a table with other women and other stories, I realised something I didn't know, which was that I wasn't in my rage anymore, and that I was actually interested in offering compassion and love and kindness to my mother.
My daughter is Grace, who's just turned 6. Mason is 4 and Lenny is 16 months. And we live in Knowle in Bristol.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
So how old were you when you became a mum?
I fell pregnant when I was 18 and I had my first when I was 19, just after.
And how did you find that that changed your relationship to your mum?
I found the first sort of year was quite difficult because I was by myself when I had Grace, and I ended up with really bad postnatal depression when she was born, and it lasted for about a year. And I think it was when she turned sort of about 6 months old, it was my mum that recognised it because she had had it herself. I say, if anything, it helped bond us because I never had a close relationship with her before that, and the fact that she recognised it, she sort of seemed to... It turned herself around because she was really supportive. She went to the doctors of me, and she was more involved in my daughter's life, so I could just find my feet a little bit.
I made it a puppet show.
A magic show, you done?
Magic show.
And so, when you were doing sort of mothering the mother, what did you actually do? What was the activity that you did that helped you reflect on that?
We had actually done a big paper doll chain, actually. We were all asked to do a paper dolls of how many women we had in our lives, or, you know, even if it was aunties who helped us with our parenting. And mine seemed to be longer than anybody else's, and it just sort of got me thinking.
Is there something that you uncovered or learnt when you were working with Mother and the Mother?
I think so, because... I was looking at it and I was thinking the older I got, the generation, the more stricter the parenting was. So I was wondering... You know, was my mum that hard on me because her mum was hard on her?
The purpose of the project was to look at your maternal relationship, how you were mothered, how you then pass that on or don't to your child. How has that played out in your relationship with your children?
So I wasn't close with my mother throughout my pregnancy. I felt like there was a big sort of loss in my life at that point that I hadn't really experienced before I came pregnant, or hadn't been so acutely aware of. It was just interesting for me that when I did have my children, there would be certain things that I would do, like I'd find myself singing songs to my children that my mother used to sing to me, things that I'd say or ways that I would do things that have definitely come down through my mother, even if we're not sort of in close contact now. I think every time I heard a woman's story, there was a little part of me that it would, you know, I would kind of have a sort of reflection on my own story at the same time. And it was quite nice to kind of, to know that there was my story sort of running along in the background, but it wasn't forefront through running this project. It was very much about collecting these other women's stories in their own right. But it was really beneficial for me personally, sort of hearing women talking about dealing with things like postnatal depression, which had kind of run through my family.
So you have two daughters who may or may not, but likely that they will become mums one day. What have you learnt from this that you could pass on to them?
I think the thing that I felt when they were young was that it was so challenging and that I so wished I had support. And I just vowed to myself at that point in my life that I will be there for them.
Pippa Robinson and the project, which started on Mother's Day 3 years ago, concludes tomorrow just ahead of this year's Mother's Day, and it's at the Knowle West Media Centre in Bristol. A quick report back on the Turkish chicken with Diana Henry. It was absolutely gorgeous. I ate rather a lot of it during that item. But some of you may have misheard what she said about cooking chicken properly. I know some of you thought she said the juices should be pink. It was absolutely the opposite. She said juices should not be pink. Cook it right through. And thank you, Diana, for a delicious early lunch. Now, we heard from so many inspiring women at the WOW Festival last week. We've been asking you to tell us who's your woman of the week. Maria from Manchester chose Sara Bahai, Afghanistan's first female taxi driver. Her fellow taxi drivers are all male in Salta and claim that she'll crash as she has epilepsy. She doesn't. Maria emailed to say, I'm seeking employment at the moment. It's proving incredibly hard. It's hard to keep going when you get so many unexplained knockbacks. I've watched Sarah's life. It really doesn't compare with mine. If an idiot in a cab shouts and insults me, I can report him. The daily grind that I face is nothing to the battles Sarah has. For Linda from London, her Woman of the Week is Anna Kennedy, who works on behalf of people with autism. Anna was a finalist in this year's BBC People's Strictly for Comic Relief, and Linda wrote, autism affects my family. Both my nieces have children on the autistic spectrum, and so I have something of an appreciation of how difficult it is to be a parent to such children. Anna Kennedy has not only coped with having two autistic sons, but has done so many positive things to help others in the same boat. Plus, she looks so well and happy. And unsurprisingly, lots of you got in touch to say your mother was your Woman of the Week, a fitting description given this Sunday is Mother's Day. Salma on Twitter said, my mum inspires me every day of every week. She raised all eight of us to be selfless, honest, hard-working people. And Kate said, my dad's been very ill in hospital and I've realised that my mum is stronger than I ever gave her credit for. So thanks to all of you who got in touch. Next week, you can contact us in the usual way by email or at BBC Women's Hour on Twitter to tell us your Woman of the Week. Now, today is Red Nose Day, and Comic Relief will no doubt bring in loads of money tonight. So far, it's raised more than £960 million. Since 2013, the charity has helped more than 12 million people in the world's poorest communities. One of their projects is the Kenyan Community Engagement Initiative Network. It helps HIV-positive women and orphan children support themselves through better nutrition and more sustainable farming. One group of women taking part in this project is called Tumani, and they live on the edge of the Kakamega forest in the west of the country. Angela Robson went to meet them and spoke first to Emily Mbogo, one of the group's founding members.
We started realizing that our members were growing thin, 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 and then later on they died, has died of AIDS. So we sat as a group, we started discussing about the issue of HIV. And thank God, from that time, those who remain with the group are still alive. So we started medication, and here we are.
I'm Grace Obudo, and I'm the Director of Community Empowerment Initiative Network. We work with 200 women who are HIV positive. The project is pulling together resources for better health and income. So they keep goats, they keep cows, and they plant trees.
Is HIV still very widespread in this area?
HIV still spread highly in the area, because of stigma. People are not talking about it. But having a group like Tumaini, we are making a breakthrough when they get out of the stigma.
Why do you want women to actually tell other people they're HIV positive?
Yeah, because others would be suffering from HIV, and the women may be suffering from HIV and they're not aware. But when they are aware, then they are able now to take treatment, to take drug adherence, and they can live and continue with their life.
So, Emily, these are some of your goats from the project.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I am very proud to have these goats because you can see they are very beautiful. I also have asthma, and they say it cures asthma.
What, goat's milk?
Yes.
So you're just feeding the cows now? What's the condition? So once they have calves of their own, that goes back to the group for the women?
Okay, the three goes back to the women.
The first three calves, and then...
Yes, and then the cow itself will remain mine.
What are the names of these cows?
This one is Ruth.
Ruth?
Yes.
That's the name of my mother.
Oh. And so I have your mother here.
Yes, yeah, so this is Ruth.
Yeah.
And this little calf here.
This one is Jade.
Jade?
Yes.
Oh, quite unusual names for cows. Ruth,
there was a program in a TV which I used to like, one of the actors, and it was called Jade.
I'm Gladys Ayuma. I'm HIV positive. I tested HIV positive while I was pregnant in the year 2007, after the death of my husband, after his burial. It was hard to accept, but through to mine, the group, one of the members visited me at home while I was still pregnant. Then I went for testing. I was found positive. By that time, I didn't accept the status because I thought I had it was the end of everything. But after going through education about HIV and AIDS, IGAs, how you can put on, how you can continue with life even if you are positive, I could not believe that I could have goats in my home, a cow, poultry. No, I didn't believe. But right now, I thank God. I make my own manure. I drink that milk. I eat my own eggs from my own chickens. Now it's my duty also to educate other people to have courage. I'm very better.
Mimi ni Catherine Amanya. Shamba yangu ndio hii. Napanda hapa mahindi, mboga.
I'm Catherine Amanya. This is my land and I plant a variety of vegetables and I'm also milking my goats.
What do you do differently now that you weren't doing before, that you've learned through this group?
Kitu yenye sikuwa nafanya hapo mbeleni. Sikuwa naweza hata kwa hii shamba yangu sikuwa napanda kitu kama mchele.
Initially, she only had maize and beans and sugar cane. But now, she has diversified. She's even able to plant rice. She's planting potatoes, cassava, and maize.
How has the project changed you as a person?
Hii mradi imenibadilisha.
She says initially she could not have money to buy vegetables, but now she eats vegetables from her own shamba. She's able to eat a variety of vegetables, which has changed her life.
The women of the Kakamega Forest in Kenya. And don't forget, Comic Relief is asking you to make your face funny for money. Go to the Woman's Hour website for links to Radio 4's gallery of presenters who told their favourite jokes and already made their faces funny. And I think I look pretty good in a red nose. Make up your own mind. Now, Sandy Chalmers, the younger sister of Judith and broadcasting legend in her own right, died last month at the age of only 74. In the 80s, just before I joined the programme, she was the editor of Woman's Hour and was the first mother of young children to sit in the driving seat. Sue McGregor was the presenter of the programme during the 4 years Sandy was here. Sue, she came in the early 80s. How surprising was it to have an editor who was virtually a lone parent of two young children?
Yes, it was quite surprising. It was surprising to me, and I'd been doing the programme then for a number of years, to know that she was the first. There were married editors, but nobody actually had young children to deal with, if you like, and Sandy certainly did. She was dealing with them on her own, and she used to come in like a sort of a smiling, happy, warm, she was a very people person, whirling dervish, carrying plastic bags, which were her office, you know, all her office that she had to take home and do work at home. And
she was famous for those plastic
Yes,
bags,
I think they were.
She?
Am I allowed to say Sainsbury's? Probably
yeah,
not.
Well, you just did.
But she was a wonderful sort of whirling dervish of a person.
What difference did she make to the content and style of the programme?
Well, that's a very good question. I've been thinking about that. I'm not sure that the content was very different, because we'd always done notable women, politics, cooking, everything, medical matters, a lot of sort of intimate sexual detail about problems and that sort of thing. But what Sandy did was she pushed the boundaries quite a bit. And as you say, she was a broadcaster herself and essentially very much a radio person herself. What she did was she expanded the Woman's Hour empire, if I can put it that way, because she created with the BBC World Service, which was based at Bush House in those days, these international phone-ins called It's Your World, which were fantastic fun to do. I was lucky enough to chair them, and with international leaders from all over the world and people ringing in from all over the world. And in those days when technology wasn't quite as good as it is now, although I do notice lines drop off from time to time, even now, it was always, you know, there was always a sort of ball in your stomach, wondering whether the person would be at the other end of the line to field an hour's worth of phone-in calls.
Did they ever go down?
They never went down, but I do remember a very, very, very close to the wire moment when Georgi Arbatov, who was Mr. Gorbachev's spokesman, who was on 2 weeks after the Chernobyl explosion, so this was the first time the Russian government had responded to the explosion. He didn't come on till about 3 minutes before we were on air, and the only reason I knew he was there was that I heard a glass and a teaspoon stirring something in the glass coming from down the line. I knew we were through to Moscow because I knew, having been to Moscow myself, the Russians love tea with jam in it, which they stir, and this was the first sign. And I can remember the enormous relief when that got through.
I mean, you got to do lots of leaders, Thatcher, Benazir Bhutto, Kenneth Colander. Why did Sandy think that international perspective was really important to her Woman's Hour audience?
I think she thought the Woman's Hour audience, was interested in absolutely everything. You've just had, if you like, an international item with Red Nose Day. I think she expanded our horizons and knew that the women listening, and quite a few men, mere men they used to write in and call themselves, I remember, they probably still do. I think she thought we were interested in everything, and it was always fascinating to learn about, politics from the mouth of the person who's sitting in Zambia or the Middle East or East Germany or whatever it was, or Moscow indeed.
She'd been a first. She was the first woman to run a local radio station. She ran Stoke. What brought her to London and the network?
Now, that's a very good question, and I'm not sure. She had family in London. She was very close to her sister, Judy. Her marriage was not going well. I think she thought it probably was, in a way, a career step up from being the first woman to run a local radio station to edit one of BBC Radio 4's most popular programmes. And she had a lot of friends in London. And through local radio, and I've just thought of this connection, which relied in those days very much and probably still does on phone-ins, that was probably how she expanded Woman's Hour's empire into this international programme on a Sunday.
Sue McGregor, lovely to have you back.
Thank you very much for
being with us this morning. Sue McGregor and I were talking about Sandy Chalmers, a former editor of Woman's Hour. Now, Diana Henry provided me with a delicious early lunch of chicken and salsa, Turkish style, but there was a bit of confusion over something Diana said about cooking chicken safely. Pinky Liverdrawer highlighted it in her tweet, saying, "Check between leg and body, the juice should be pink. Isn't that shouldn't? Thought chicken juices ran clear when cooked." Yes, Pinky, the juices should be clear, which in fact Diana said, but I think the "n't" fell off the end of "should." It is definitely that they should run clear. And still on the subject of chicken, Anne said, "I'm concerned that the only reason considered for not using intensively reared birds was because of the risk to human health of salmonella. Surely it's just as important that the animals we eat are not cruelly reared." And I thought this was part of Hugh Fernley Whittingstall's campaign as well. And we also discussed how your mother affected the way you become a mother. Millie Charles met Pippa Robinson in Bristol. She runs a storytelling project and has worked with more than 100 mothers in the last 3 years. And Joe emailed to say, "Charlotte could have been describing my relationship with my alcoholic mother. Thanks to her for sharing her story so honestly. Usually I ignore the lack of a relationship with my mum, but this time of year is particularly hard for me. I didn't realise until my late 30s what impact her lack of mothering had had on me, and I wonder what I would be like if I'd had an attentive mother. Needless to say, I try and do the opposite with my own children." Well, don't forget it's Mother's Day, or Mothering Sunday, as some people prefer, this Sunday. And also don't forget, Comic Relief is raising money today and asking you to make your faces funny for money. And you can hear one of my favourite jokes told by me sporting a red nose if you follow the link from the Woman's Hour website to Radio 4's gallery of presenters. Don't miss the highlights of the week on Woman's Hour's weekend edition tomorrow at 4 o'clock. Join us next week. Bye-bye.